What if the absolute worst thing you could do for your child's spiritual life is to give them, like, just a little bit of Jesus?
I mean, that is quite a hook.
Right. Well, welcome to this deep dive. And if you're a member of Harmony Christian Church, you know, we're sitting down today with a very specific mission.
Yeah, we are getting you prepped, primed, and completely ready for your upcoming Connect Group discussion.
Exactly. We're unpacking Kent Wagner's message from this past weekend, and we're looking specifically at a concept that honestly is a bit unsettling.
Oh, totally unsettling.
So during Family Sunday, and remember, this is with all the kids in the service, you know, toddlers running the aisles, just absolute chaos.
Beautiful chaos, but yeah, chaos.
Right. Kent dropped this central metaphor. He said the modern church has a habit of inoculating our kids with the gospel when really our actual job is to infect them with it.
Yeah, hearing a pastor stand on a stage and tell his congregation to infect the next generation. I mean, that goes against every instinct we have, especially when you think about the cultural baggage of that word. But when you look at the biological mechanics of what an inoculation actually is, the metaphor isn't just provocative,
Right.
it's this incredibly precise diagnosis of a cultural problem.
Well, let's break down that biology for a second, because Kent asked who watches the needle go in at the doctor's office, but he didn't give us like a full biology
No,
lesson.
he spared us the textbook.
Yeah, thank goodness. But what is the actual mechanism he's tapping into here?
So think about how a vaccine functions in the human body. When you inoculate someone, you aren't protecting them by like hiding them from a virus.
Right, you're exposing them to it.
Exactly. You are intentionally introducing a tiny, weakened, or sometimes entirely dead portion of that exact virus into their system.
So it's basically a decoy.
Yes. You give the body just enough of the pathogen so that the immune system notices it, recognizes it as a foreign invader, and, well, goes to work building antibodies to neutralize it.
Okay, so the body learns how to defeat it. Meaning, the next time the actual full-strength virus tries to enter the system, the body's defenses are already programmed to reject it on sight.
And that is the terrifying parallel Kent is drawing here.
Wow.
Because parents often think they're doing their job by giving their kids this tiny, diluted dose of Christianity.
Like a little bit of Sunday school.
Yeah. A memory verse on the fridge, a quick prayer before eating a meal. It's a weakened, compartmentalized version of the faith that requires almost nothing of them.
Man, I see where this is going. The kid grows up, they go off to college or, you know, enter the workforce. And suddenly they encounter the real demanding, all-consuming call of Jesus.
But their system instinctively fights it off.
Right, because they look at true discipleship and think, oh, I've already had this. I did the youth group thing. I know what this is and I don't need it.
Exactly. They have literally developed intellectual and cultural antibodies against the gospel because they've been trained to view faith as an accessory, you know, not a reality.
So a superficial faith provides a false sense of security.
Yeah, the child believes they possess the cure, but all they possess is an immunity to the real thing.
Wait, I have to push back on this a little because it sounds like Kent is suggesting that doing a little bit of church is actually worse than doing nothing at all.
I know, it sounds extreme.
I mean, are we really saying a parent shouldn't even bother with Sunday school if they aren't going to go all in?
Well, what's fascinating here is he's arguing that half measures create an illusion that is uniquely dangerous.
Okay, how so?
Because if someone has never heard the gospel at all, they are at least a blank slate. They might be hungry for meaning.
That makes sense.
But someone who has been inoculated believes they've already tried Christianity and just found it boring or, you know, irrelevant. The barrier to entry is actually much higher because you first have to dismantle all those antibodies.
Okay, that actually makes me think about how people learn foreign languages.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, like if you're prepping for a vacation and you just memorize a few tourist phrases, you know, how to ask for the bathroom, how to order a coffee, you feel pretty accomplished.
Right, you feel like you speak the language.
Exactly.
Yeah.
But the second you land in the country and face a rapid-fire, complex conversation with a native speaker, you completely abandon the language.
You just freeze.
You freeze and you revert back to your native tongue because those tourist phrases have, like, zero structural integrity. You can't survive on them.
That's such a good point.
Compare that to full immersion, where the language surrounds you until it literally rewires how you dream and think.
Yeah.
Kent is basically saying we can't hand our kids tourist Christianity.
Tourist Christianity, that is the perfect way to articulate the inoculation. because Kent's vision of being infected means the host is entirely overtaken.
Yeah.
An infection dictates how your body behaves. So in a spiritual sense, it dictates how you react to financial stress, how you handle a crisis at work, how you treat someone who slanders you.
It becomes the operating system of the house.
Yeah.
So as you head into your Connect groups this week, listener, this is the first real mirror we have to hold up. Think about the household you grew up in.
Oh, that's a tough one.
Were you handed a tourist phrase book, or were you immersed? Were you inoculated, or were you infected?
It's a heavy baseline to establish, for sure. But once we recognize the threat of inoculation, the immediate question becomes a matter of transmission.
Right. How do we pass it on?
Yeah, how do we ensure we are passing on a contagious faith rather than a deadened one?
Well, Kent gave us a framework to answer that, using the acronym AAAIM.
Right.
And the first step, the A, stands for actively pursuing Jesus.
Mm.
And he used that classic, almost worn-out church trope of the Sunday morning car fight to illustrate this.
Oh, man, we all know the cliche.
Right. Parents screaming at each other, threatening the kids in the minivan, and then pacing on these giant, terrifying smiles the second they hit the church parking lot.
It's a cliche for a reason, but Kent didn't just bring it up for a laugh. He tied it to a deeply ingrained psychological mechanism in children.
Right.
He talked about how kids learn to say, "I'm sorry," as a meaningless reflex. They punch their brother, get caught, robotically apologize to dad, and then turn around and punch their brother again.
Because the words are empty.
Exactly. The action is unchanged. Kids understand hypocrisy very early on.
Yeah, and Kent told his kids, "Show me, don't tell me." He just stopped accepting the verbal apologies without behavioral change.
Yeah.
But then, here's where it gets really interesting. He flipped that exact standard onto the adults. Show me, don't tell me.
Ouch.
Right. Because a child's brain is constantly scanning their environment for incongruence. When they see their primary authority figures, their parents preaching grace and patience, but living out rage and bitterness, it creates massive cognitive dissonance.
And children resolve cognitive dissonance in a very predictable way. They don't usually conclude that their parents are just struggling, flawed humans who need grace.
No, they don't have that nuance.
Right. They conclude that the religion itself is fake. And this is where Kent introduced the concept of the multiplier effect. A parent's life acts as a multiplier for a child's spiritual trajectory.
Let's drill down into the mechanics of that multiplier. Why does the negative behavior of a Christian parent push a kid away so much faster than, say, a parent who just doesn't believe in God at all?
Well, because the secular parent is at least congruent. What they say aligns with what they do.
I see.
But when a parent claims to possess the ultimate truth of the universe and then behaves with cruelty or, like, chronic anxiety, the hypocrisy acts as an accelerant.
It pushes them away faster.
Way faster. It multiplies how fast the child runs away from the faith because they feel like they have to put distance between themselves and that perceived manipulation.
So they spend their 20s undoing the damage of a household that claimed Jesus but functioned like the world.
Exactly. But on the flip side, authentic faith acts as a positive multiplier. When a parent's life is genuinely transformed, it multiplies the speed at which the child runs toward the faith.
We should probably clarify, though, that authenticity does not mean moral perfection.
Oh, definitely not.
Because Kent made a point to say we shouldn't just try to be better fakes. One of the most radical things he suggested was that parents need to actively apologize to their children when they fail.
Yeah, that's huge.
Sitting down on the edge of the bed and saying, "I lost my temper earlier. That doesn't reflect who I want to be for Jesus, and I was wrong."
And that level of vulnerability requires a total dismantling of parental ego.
It really reminds me of the dynamic between a corporate boss and their team.
How so?
Well, if you work for a manager who refuses to ever admit a mistake, who constantly shifts blame to maintain this aura of perfection, you eventually stop trusting a single word they say. You resent them.
Oh, 100%.
But when a leader steps into a meeting and says, "Look, I completely blew that call, I misread the market, and I am sorry," the trust in the room skyrockets. It doesn't diminish their authority, it actually validates it.
Because it proves the leader is submitted to reality. And when a parent apologizes to a child, they are proving to the child that mom and dad are not the ultimate authority in the universe.
Right.
It shows the child that the parents are submitted to a higher boss, Jesus. It gives the child a real-time, living example of what repentance actually looks like.
It's the difference between telling a kid what grace is,
yeah,
and letting them watch you rely on it.
Beautifully said.
But personal faith can't exist in a vacuum. The moment two infected people try to raise a family, The true test of that faith becomes how they treat each other when the kids are watching.
Yes.
Which pivots us to the I in the AIM acronym, invest in relationships, specifically the relationship between the parents.
And this is arguably the most crucial psychological building block in a child's development. And it's one our modern culture gets completely backwards.
Seriously backwards. Kent shared a story from his days driving a youth group van that illustrates this so well. He looked in the rearview mirror and saw a high school senior crying quietly in the back seat. So he asked her what was going on, and she confessed that she knew her parents were planning to get a divorce the absolute second she graduated.
If we connect this to the bigger picture, the parents in that scenario were operating under a very common, deeply flawed assumption.
That they were protecting her.
Right. They thought they were protecting their daughter. They manufactured this intact family unit to get her across the high school finish line, assuming that an 18-year-old would be mature enough to handle the fracture of the family without it damaging her.
But she was completely shattered before she even walked across the stage. Her foundation was disintegrating underneath her.
Because when we look at child psychology, we see a societal shift toward hyper-child-centric parenting. We have this modern obsession with being our kids' best friends, making sure they are the center of the household universe.
Everything revolves around them.
Exactly. But a child's true psychological security does not come from their bond with their parents. Their primary source of stability comes from the strength of the parents' relationship with each other.
That feels entirely countercultural. I mean, we're told constantly to put the kids first.
Always. But putting the kids first places an unbearable weight on them. If a child goes to bed sensing chronic, unresolved tension between mom and dad, even if mom and dad are perfectly sweet to the child, the emotional floor they stand on is vibrating.
Wow. Vibrating.
In a state of chronic ambient anxiety, a child cannot absorb spiritual leadership. The parent is trying to teach them about a loving, secure heavenly father while the child's earthly fortress is crumbling.
It's the oxygen mask analogy on an airplane.
Yeah.
You have to secure your own mask before helping your child.
Exactly.
If you let your marriage suffocate because you are driving your kids to 6 different travel sports practices and band camps, everyone passes out.
Yes.
So Ken gave us some incredibly gritty, practical advice on how to force oxygen back into the marriage. He called the first tactic couch time.
Couch time is brilliant in its simplicity. 10 minutes a day.
Just 10 minutes. But the mechanics of those 10 minutes are highly specific.
Oh, yeah.
It's the first 10 minutes when both parents are home. You sit on the couch, look at each other, and you explicitly tell your children no.
That is the hardest part for people.
It is. When a toddler runs up wanting attention, dad says, "This is your mother's time. I will play with you in 10 minutes.
Right.
Mom says, "This is your father's time." You actively force the kids to wait outside the boundary of the marriage.
And think about what that signals to a child's brain. At first, they might push back or throw a tantrum because they aren't used to being denied the center stage.
Right.
But very quickly, that boundary creates profound security. It physically demonstrates to the children that the core of the family is unshakable.
They're a united front.
Exactly. The kids realize they do not have to hold the family together with their own performance or behavior because the adults have it under control.
Kent also brought up dating. He told this story about when he and his wife were broke, and their date night consisted of putting the kids in the cart at Sam's Club, buying cheap pizza slices, and just walking the aisles to talk.
I love that.
You cannot stop dating and just become roommates who manage a household logistics calendar.
No, you can't. And, you know, he also recognized the reality of the room during Family Sunday. Not everyone is in an intact marriage.
Right. There are single parents, divorced parents, people co-parenting in really complex situations.
And the principle of investing in relationships still rigorously applies to them, specifically regarding who they allow into their family's ecosystem.
Yes. His advice there was uncompromising.
It was. If you are single, do not bring anyone into your children's lives who lacks the actual visible fruit of following Jesus.
Right. Not just someone who goes to church.
Not someone who knows the right church vocabulary or someone who checks the Christian box on a dating profile, but someone whose life produces the fruit of the Spirit.
Because if a potential partner is going to lead your children further away from a secure faith, you have to defend that boundary fiercely.
You can't love your kids well or a future spouse well if you aren't drawing from the well of loving Jesus first.
Okay, so we have A, actively pursuing Jesus personally so you aren't a hypocrite. We have I, investing in the foundational marital relationships to give kids psychological security.
And that leads us to the final piece of the acronym.
Right. The M measured spiritual leadership. So what does this all mean?
This is where the actual teaching and discipleship happens.
I have to be honest, though. The word measured gave me pause during the service.
Really? Why?
Well, if the goal is to infect our kids with an all-consuming gospel, measured sounds like a complete contradiction. It sounds like scaling back or holding back or doing less.
Ah, I see what you mean.
Why would Kent tell us to be measured if we were trying to cause an infection?
Because measured doesn't mean doing less. It means executing with acute situational awareness rather than just dumping theology on a child all at once. Kent used the analogy of teaching a teenager how to drive to explain this.
Well, just sitting in the passenger seat with a white-knuckle grip on the door handle.
Exactly. When you have been driving for 20 years, you process hundreds of variables subconsciously. But when you put a 15-year-old behind the wheel, you can't just hand them the car's owner manual and say, "Read this, now you know how to drive."
That would be a disaster.
Total disaster. You have to measure your instruction based on the immediate environment. You point out the motorcycle in the blind spot. You explain why we brake early in the rain.
Oh, I get it.
You are mapping the instruction directly onto the reality the teenager is experiencing in real time.
Which is the exact opposite of what so many well-meaning Christian parents do. Kent shared that story about his own dad.
Yes, the living room story.
Right. His dad went to church, heard a sermon on leading his family, felt incredibly guilty, went home, sat the boys down in the middle of the living room, and just aggressively read the Bible at them while they were itching to go play with their toys.
It was a performative data dump.
A data dump. Exactly.
It wasn't tied to their reality. It was forced. And consequently, it was a one-time event that never happened again.
Because it lacked the situational awareness of a driving instructor. And it ignored the instruction the Apostle Paul gave in the New Testament about correcting and encouraging with great patience and careful instruction.
Yes.
You had to map the theology onto the child's actual Tuesday afternoon. Which brings us to the butterfly story.
Oh, the butterfly story.
Yeah.
This perfectly encapsulates what measured leadership looks like in practice.
Cantex talked about how young kids inevitably ask those big wondering questions like, "Daddy, how does a butterfly fly?"
Right.
Kent admitted his first instinct as a young dad was to just make up some goofy fairy tale. Oh, they have sprinkly magic dust on their wings? It's an easy out.
We've all done it.
But he overheard another parent answer that exact same question, and the parent chose to use the moment for measured instruction.
Instead of inventing magic, that parent explained actual biology and physics, but pointed it directly back to God. They explained that God gave the butterfly a tiny body and massive wings. They talked about how God designed the air to have pressure. You can feel it when you wave your hand, and how the butterfly uses the air pressure God invented to lift itself up.
Think about the psychological worldview shift that happens in a child's brain from that 60-second conversation.
It was massive.
It wasn't a rigid, awkward 45-minute Bible study. It was a casual observation. But instead of the child growing up thinking the world is run by made-up fairy dust, they grow up seeing God as the master designer of aerodynamics.
Yeah.
It merges faith with physical reality. It makes God relevant to Monday, not to the character we sing about on Sunday.
And that is the defining characteristic of an infection. It spreads into everything.
Right.
When you are paying your bills and you set aside money for the church, you stop and explain to your kids why you are giving it away. When you are reading your Bible on the couch, you don't hide it. You let them interrupt you and you tell them, "I'm reading about Jesus. I'll play with you in 10 minutes. You are constantly measuring out spiritual truths in bite-sized, highly contextual moments.
And Ken drove this home at the very end of Family Sunday. Instead of taking communion as this silent, hyper-individualistic ritual where everyone closes their eyes, he had the families take the bread and the juice and physically turn to each other.
Right there in the pews.
Right there in the pews. He told the parents to ask their kids, "What do you think it felt like for Jesus to have those nails put in his hands?" He forced the parents to articulate out loud to their children why the cross actually matters to them.
It broke the performative silence of church and forced authentic, measured instruction. It was a beautiful reflection of the early church, integrating the reality of the gospel into a shared family moment.
So as you head into your connect groups to dissect all of this, let's lock down the AIM framework.
Let's do it.
If we are going to stop inoculating the next generation with a weak, easily discarded tourist faith, we have to infect them. We do that by A, actively pursuing Jesus, showing not just telling. So our authenticity acts as a positive multiplier.
Right.
Investing in our primary relationships, creating an unshakable psychological floor for our kids to stand on, and M-measured spiritual leadership, using the patience of a driving instructor to connect God to the everyday physics of a butterfly.
It is a demanding framework.
Yeah.
But the beauty of it is that it relies entirely on your authenticity, not your perfection. You don't have to be a theologian. You just have to be honest.
Just honest.
But before you circle up with your small group this week, I want to leave you with one final thread to pull on.
Okay.
We have spent this whole time discussing intentionality, apologizing, enforcing couch time, explaining the butterfly. But children are brilliant observers of what we don't say.
Well, that's interesting. What do you mean?
Well, if a child's faith is ultimately a mirror of a parent's hidden priorities, what about the moments we aren't actively trying to teach? Think about how you handle traffic, how you speak about your boss at the dinner table, what you prioritize on a weekend when you're exhausted. What is the accidental gospel you are currently infecting your kids with on a random Tuesday?
Wow. That is a staggering question to take into your Connect group. What is the accidental gospel of your household? Thank you all for joining us for this deep dive. Have a fantastic discussion this week at Harmony Christian Church, and we will see you next time. Keep diving deep.